I will indeed be talking about how to apply the matrix product state formalism, but in the way that it was now described by Frank, so in the continuous setting, to relativistic quantum field theories. And this is based on joint work with Tobias, Ignatius Hirak, Frank, and Henri Verschelde, who was my PhD supervisor. So it's based on, well, in this paper and the archive version is slightly different. This is, corresponds to a proceeding. Okay, this works. So maybe I should start by explaining what is the main difference between non-relativistic and relativistic quantum field theories. So as mentioned by Frank, in some sense we can always interpret the true ground state of a non-relativistic system as just this empty omega state, which contains nothing. But of course this is not what we're interested in when studying non-relativistic theories. So we added a chemical potential to the Hamiltonian. And then the ground state is just some state with a finite density of particles. So you just have a collection of particles which, due to interactions, will be entangled. But there is this finite density. This means that if you zoom in and if you look at distances which are much smaller than the typical distance between two particles, then basically you will just see this omega state again, which is completely empty, which is very dull. Whereas when studying relativistic quantum systems, well, we could also be interested in finite density states, etc. But in the first place now, the ground state, the so-called vacuum, is already very interesting and very non-trivial. In the sense that it has entanglement, and in fact, very much entanglement. And so this ground state is built up out of quantum fluctuations. And so these are not really particles. We're studying the vacuum. There are no physical particles. But in some sense, especially in this description, we will interpret these fluctuations as a kind of particles. And then the fact that this ground state has to be Lorentz invariant requires that these fluctuations appear at all momentum scales. Because, well, if you have some fluctuation and in some way you can assign a momentum p to it, then by just doing a Lorentz boost, this fluctuation now lives at a possibly higher momentum, but this would be the same state. So these fluctuations are present for all momentum scales up to infinite momenta. And this is actually exactly the cause of all these divergences that you get when studying relativistic quantum field theories. And this requires us to introduce some kind of regularization. So in this formalism, we will be using the variational principle, which has some advantages. So especially in a relativistic quantum field theory, one of the big ways of computing things is perturbation theory. But many interesting properties, for example, confinement in QCD, cannot be found using perturbation expansions. It's a non-perturbative effect, and the variational principle has been able to, not for QCD of course, but in other theories, has been able to reproduce non-perturbative effects. If you compare it to Monte Carlo approaches, then with the variational approach you wouldn't have a sign problem. So this was one of the main topics of the talk by Philip Corbos. That we can now study systems which are inaccessible by Monte Carlo. And well, as I said, the variational principle has been applied successfully in many cases. I think textbook example in single particle in a quantum mechanics course is the quartic potential. In quantum chemistry, and here I should also add nuclear physics, because these two fields use the same kind of methods, namely Hartree-Fock, and then all its more complex follow-ups, such as configuration interaction, coupled cluster, etc. You have also density functional theory, which is based on the variational principle. And so, as was shown during this workshop, for quantum lattice systems, there have been many breakthroughs the last two decades, thanks to mainly this DMRG, and then the insight from quantum information theory that we can generalize this to arbitrary tensor networks. Non-relativistic quantum field theories were the topic of Frank's talk. So what about relativistic quantum field theories? Frank has already mentioned that the variational principle has been studied in the context of relativistic quantum field theories, even by Richard Feynman. But he was not positive about what he found, and he concluded that trying to apply the variational principle to this setting is no damn good at all. And the reason for this very strong conclusion that Feynman had is based on three arguments, which seem very, very severe. So the first one is what he called the sensitivity to high frequencies, and it's based on the observation that the variational principle has only one goal. It tries to minimize the ground state energy. But in a relativistic quantum field theory, this ground state energy is not really an interesting quantity. It's even divergent. And that is because it is dominated by all these zero-point fluctuations. But of course, the Lorentz transformations tell us that fluctuations at a higher momentum will have a larger effect on the energy. So the most important, the most dominant contributions to the ground state energy come exactly from these fluctuations that are living there at very high and even infinite momentum scales. And so if we have some kind of variational ansatz with some parameters, what will happen is the variational principle will just try to tune these parameters such that the high frequencies are correctly described. But this is not at all what we want, because all the interesting quantities, the observable physics, is generated by long distance behavior, by degrees of freedom living at large length scales. And so this is often very ill described by a variational method. Second problem, so as I said, I think the way that Feynman attacked this problem is by looking at what was done, for example, in nuclear physics, where a good scheme to find the variational ansatz for some problem is to start from a free theory, some quadratic problem, take the ground state of that, add some excitation, single particle, two particle, three particle, and use this finite basis as a kind of expansion, expand the ground state of your interacting theory in this basis. The problem is all these higher particle excitations, these n particle excitations, in an extensive problem, so a nuclear physics problem would be a nucleus, would be something of finite size, but if you do this in an extensive setting, then all these n particle excitations, they do not contribute, because their contribution to the energy is not proportional to the volume of the system. And so in an infinite volume limit, there is no effect on the energy density. And there is a more mathematical way of phrasing this, which is to say that the ground state of this interacting problem will live in a different Hilbert space. And it's not contained in the space that you can construct from the ground state and higher order particle excitations of this free theory. So it's very hard to go beyond this ground state, this Gaussian ansatz, this ground state of a free theory. And then, well, it's very hard, it's maybe an exaggeration. People know how to do this, and even in a finite size setting, this has been done, and it's called the coupled cluster method, so in quantum chemistry and in nuclear physics. But this is a very expensive method. So if you do it to a system with a finite number of particles, it scales, I don't know the precise scaling, but it scales terrible in the number of particles. And if you do it in the infinite size setting, so if you try to do it for an extensive state, then in the end, you have not really simplified your problem, because to compute anything, to compute any expectation value, you just have to compute another path integral, the functional integral again. The only thing that you have gained is that it's one dimension less. So Feynman didn't know how to compute such a thing accurately, and if you just use an approximation to compute expectation values, then you cannot use your variational principle at all, because you will be using a wrong expression for the ground state energy. So these are three major difficulties. Well, these second and third arguments have not really anything to do with the fact that these systems are relativistic. So these apply to all extended systems. And for lattice systems, we have now all these tensor networks. And for non-relativistic field theories, we have the continuous matrix product states. And these have proven to be indeed extensive states. The continuous matrix product states were constructed such to describe a state with a finite density of particles, so an infinite number of excitations. So this is a perfectly extensive state. And at the same time, it allows for a very efficient and accurate evaluation of expectation values. It's an exact evaluation in the case of matrix product states and continuous. And for these PEPs, et cetera, you have to make some approximations, but it's still very accurate. And so the main insight that led to all these developments is, well, this D in density matrix stands for density matrix. And so it's related to insights from quantum information regarding entanglement in these systems. And actually, Feynman, even though he was very negative about the variational principle, he did foresee in the discussion after his talk, he did foresee something. And he even mentioned that there should be some other description which is based on something like density matrices. So he had a kind of intuition that this approach might provide a solution. So we still have Feynman's first concern. And this applies to all theories with a wide range of length scales that are interacting. So the important length scales in any system, in any extended system, are, well, the longest length scale, which is the IR, the infrared cutoff, and which is given by the correlation length, and the ultraviolet cutoff, which in a lattice would be the lattice spacing. In a non-relativistic field theory, is related to the density. And in a relativistic theory, well, in principle, there is no ultraviolet cutoff. And so whenever the ratio of these two length scales goes to infinity, we have a major difficulty with this sensitivity to high frequencies. And so for matrix product states and PEPs, for matrix product states, it was already mentioned that in the case of critical theory, so when this correlation length goes to infinity, they don't work very well anymore. But you can, of course, do some the scaling, which was based here on this argument of finite D. For relativistic theories, they can be critical or non-critical, but the main problem is here in this lack of an ultraviolet cutoff. And actually, the best solution, which is able to avoid even this first argument of Feynman, are the MIRA, the multiscale entanglement renormalization ansatz, which will be introduced tomorrow. So in order to compute something with relativistic quantum field theories, we need to define some kind of regularization scheme. And here we're working with the variational principle. We're working in a Schrödinger picture where we have quantum states. So we need to build in some kind of regularization in our quantum states. So there is no time in our description, or we work at a fixed times point in time. So we will only be able to regularize the spatial components, which means that we will unavoidably be breaking Lorentz invariants. But of course, we expect that in some limit, we will be able to restore this Lorentz invariants. Whether this is actually the case, so whether we flow to the correct critical or fixed point in the renormalization group sense or not, is an important question to address and something I will not discuss in this presentation. So how can we regularize a quantum state in this sense? We could use lattice regularization, but then we're back at all these lattice methods. Or we could try to use a continuous matrix product state. And Frank already discussed that these states have a kind of inherent regularization in them. So here is a definition for a continuous matrix product state again. So we have these matrices Q and R, which are matrices of finite size D, which is called the bond dimension. And we have one R for every flavor of particle that we would like to add. And in this case, because the way that these states are formulated is using creation and annihilation operators, it's easiest to do it for fermions, because relativistic fermions are also relativistic field theories for fermions are also formulated using exactly these kind of operators. Gauge theories and relativistic bosons, they're not using these Kreyszig and annihilation operators. So this would require some more steps. We're looking into this. But at this point, we've only succeeded of completely finished the fermion case, the fermionic case. So fermions, relativistic fermions in 1+1 dimension, they have two Dirac components. To the spinner, the Dirac spinner has two components. So we have here two fermionic creation, field creation operators, and two corresponding matrices R. We're always going to work in the thermodynamic limit. So there's no this trace that appeared in the definition of Frank here. These are just boundary vectors. Since this relativistic theories, fundamental theories, are supposed to be translation invariant, we will focus on translation invariant ground states. And this allows us to choose this Q and R space independent, so they do not depend on X. And I've already mentioned this. So what are the properties of these states? So as I already mentioned, they are extensive. They're definitely non-Gaussian, so they avoid the second and the third of Feynman arguments. They allow for evaluation of expectation values. And then this is the main property for this talk, this regularization that was mentioned by Frank. And since we're working with two fermions, the necessary condition is that these two matrices anti-commute. So the matrices themselves are nilpotent, R squared is zero. And the two different, R1, R2, should anti-commute. And then we have the property that the momentum occupation of particles, but you should interpret as the momentum occupation of fluctuations in the ground state, is regularized in the sense that for large momenta, their density will decay as 1 over the momentum to the power 4. So this is the definition of this momentum occupation. Another property which was not mentioned is the fact that if you apply a scale transformation to such a continuous matrix product state, this actually has a very nice, this induces a very nice transformation of the matrices Q and R, namely Q is in this way. So if you replace Q and R by in this way, then what will happen is the momentum occupation number will change in this way. And so in this intrinsic cutoff, so to this 1 over p to the power 4 decay, we can associate a cutoff lambda because, well, this momentum occupation is a dimensionless quantity. So if this goes as 1 over p to the power 4, for large momenta, there is an associated cutoff scale lambda. And by doing this transformation, we are able to shift this cutoff to some different value. And this is actually, this will give rise to Feynman sensitivity to high frequencies for the case of continuous matrix product states. Yes?
I'd like to understand what you said a bit better. So you transform space.
Yes.
And in order to recover the same wave function?
No. It's not the same. So the wave function itself is not scale invariant.
Okay, so what
it's a different, so it's really, you transform space, you compress space, all the particles are closer together, so yes, you have a different density, it's a different state.
Right, and this different state is related to the original state by this change in
Yes, indeed. Okay. By this change in parameters, but it's a different state, different density, and hence a different cutoff.
And it's not scale invariant, the state itself is.
The state itself is not scale invariant.
Which is, it's clear, it's very clear.
Okay. So what will happen now if we apply the variational principle?
Yes. I'm trying to understand. So you want to study relativistic systems. What are you going to do to study relativistic systems? You are going to use the same ansatz?
Yes. Okay. We use the same ansatz. And, well, if we don't do anything, if we just take some relativistic Hamiltonian, we apply this ansatz, and we just try to see what happens, then this is actually what's causing the problems. Because there are some terms in the Hamiltonian, the terms in the Hamiltonian that have the highest scaling dimension, which is typically the kinetic energy and other normalizable terms. If somehow at some point we have a state such that these terms with the highest scaling dimension have already a negative expectation value, then by just doing this transformation, we can indeed lower this energy very rapidly. So what will happen is basically that the variational principle will just try to lower the energy by doing the scale transformation, by sending this cutoff to infinity. So this is what will happen. And the big difference between relativistic and non-relativistic field theories is that with non-relativistic field theories, the kinetic energy is a positive definite operator. So the kinetic energy is typically the object, the part of the Hamiltonian with the highest scaling dimension. But in a non-relativistic theory, it's positive definite, which means if you do a scale transformation which puts particles closer together, their kinetic energy will start to increase and increase. But in relativistic relativistic field theories, it's not positive definite, so it can have a negative energy expectation value. And as soon as this happens, then just doing this transformation is sufficient to send the energy to minus infinity, to send the cutoff to minus infinity. But this is not good. This is really not good. And I will explain on the next slide why this is a major problem. So you can also interpret it from momentum space. These fluctuations with high momentum have the highest impact on the ground state energy. So having some kind of fluctuation which is good, just sending it to a higher momentum by doing the scale transformation, and it has an even better effect on the energy. But the problem is that we are not interested in the degrees of freedom at high momentum, but those at low momentum. And there are some arguments also based on experience that matrix product states and continuous matrix product states are able to describe the ground state very accurately, including the low energy behavior, whenever this bond dimension D is proportional to the logarithm of the ratio of ultraviolet and infrared cutoff. So here we should use a cutoff in the continuous matrix product state, but when the variational principle pushes this cutoff to infinity, well then our D will definitely be too small. And so what will happen is the high momentum, the degrees of freedom at high momentum might still be well described, but these are not interesting. But everything at low energy behavior, the low energy behavior will be totally wrong. You will not get anything physical out of there. So graphically, this would look like this. So you have some kind of levels, some kind of fluctuations that you want to have in your system. And of course, in a continuous matrix product state, these have some kind of internal cutoffs. So at some point, the density of these or the occupation of these fluctuations will go to zero as 1/(4). But then the variational principle will just rescale this whole picture and try to send this cutoff to infinity. But there will be here at low frequencies this region which is very ill-described, where there are fluctuations are not correctly described. And this will become the dominant region when C is going to infinity. So what's the solution to this problem? Well, the solution is to prevent this C from running to infinity. So if C would run to infinity, Q and R scale, well, proportional with C and proportional with the square root of C. So the entities and these matrices will also become infinity. So the way to regularize the field theory is by trying to bound these matrices. And we can do this by adding a term to the Hamiltonian, which has a higher scaling dimension, but in the Wilson sense of renormalization group, this means that this will be an irrelevant term. So it should be such that the low energy dynamics is not changed, but at high energy, the asymptotic solution for the ground state is such that, well, it should be empty. It should correspond to this empty vacuum that is chosen. This might seem fishy at first, but, well, this is just as valid as any regularization scheme. It's the renormalizability of a theory that allows you to do this and still extract correct physics by then sending this cutoff gradually back to infinity. So we have chosen to use the following term, which might seem familiar because it's just a classical kinetic energy. You can check that this one has a higher scaling dimension than the relativistic kinetic energy. We have not chosen it because it's a classical kinetic energy, but actually because it does what we want. If you evaluate it in this continuous matrix product state formalism, you can see that this actually puts a bound on the norm of the matrices Q and R. So it will, of course, this of course breaks relativistic invariance, which was unavoidable. I told this at the beginning of the presentation.
I'm sorry, you just made the comment. You said if you add this term in the Hamiltonian,
yes,
then when you try to optimize the matrices Q and R,
yes,
they suddenly the optimal solution is not infinite.
It's not infinite, indeed. Okay. This bound because this one is positive definite, and so it is related to the norm of the matrices Q and R, and you can interpret this just as a Lagrange parameter to bound the norm. But
it's irrelevant terms.
It's irrelevant.
It does not affect
the low energy dynamics. That's indeed the case, and yeah, just already by just the canonical dimensions, you can see that well, you need prefactor 1 over something momentum here, which is the cutoff. So if you send this cutoff back to infinity, this term will disappear again. But this is of course not proof for the fact that you flow back to the correct theory for the low energy behavior, but it's a hand-waving argument. So it changes the dispersion relation a little bit at high, changes it drastically at high momentum, but at low momentum, still recover the same thing. And one of the advantages of using this whole scheme and not just putting it on the lattice is that we have no fermion doublers. And well, the reason is quite simple. The reason that you have fermion doublers is because the momentum space of a lattice is periodic, whereas here we just have the lattice space of a continuum theory, which is infinite but not closed at plus and minus infinity. And so this is actually the main ingredient of what we did. And now we can try to test this. So the first example we studied is just free fermions. So this might seem trivial, but it's important to remember that we're dealing here with the real space approach. So in momentum space, free theories are very easy to solve. But in real space, there is not much difference between a free theory or a quadratic theory and an interacting theory, because the variational parameters are related to real space. This means that they affect both the low and the high frequency behavior, the low and the high momenta, the degrees of freedom living at low and high momentum in the theory. And so Feynman's sensitivity to high frequencies is applicable to even to free cases. So when Feynman presented this talk, he only talked about interacting theories because, well, free theories, in his eyes, this was very simple. You just go to momentum space, and then you have a way to decouple degrees of freedom living at high scales and degrees of freedom living at low scales. But if you work in real space, then real space degrees of freedom couple low and high scales even in a free theory.
So what is the form of R and Q for free theory? And what is T?
So the bond dimension is mentioned here, but this is not the full bond dimension. So what I did is, because you have this fermion, so I need to impose this anti-commutation relation. So you need to have that. The R's themselves are nilpotent, and R1, R2, anti-commute. So one way to parameterize this is to set R1 equal to some sigma 1 plus just Pauli matrix times 2 by 2 unit matrix. times some d by d matrix. But so the actual bond dimension here is 4 times the dimension of this one. So this d there is the dimension of this guy. And R2 is then sigma z1. So this is just the typical Jordan-Wigner scheme. And then in order for this anti-commutation, this takes care of a minus sign when these commute. So these two should commute. So these you can, the way I got these two commutes by just choosing them diagonal. And then Q can be not completely arbitrary because you still have to take care of parity, et cetera. But Q can have support in both subspaces.
But the ground state should have a suppose I look at the vacuum, the free Fermi system.
No, not really. Even for the ground state, this is a very complicated problem. You try to fill the Dirac C. So you start with, because you start with this omega. Okay, this is mainly probably an important point that I should have mentioned. So the Dirac equation gives you two dispersion relations. Well, this would be for a gapped system. And then the way to solve the free fermion theory is just to fill this C, Dirac C. But now, due to our cutoff term, we will only try to fill it up to some momentum, which is not exactly, but roughly equal to lambda. But we start with a theory with a state, this omega state, which hasn't filled anything. So what this whole CMPS construction tries to do is to get all these levels filled. But it's only able to do this approximately. And this is
maybe it's not related to context. We have a slated determinant.
Yes.
Block states.
Yes.
So you will be rewriting it in this exponential form.
Yeah, but it's
too negative.
But this would look very nice in momentum space, right?
In momentum space, it looks very nice.
But in real space. So.
But in real space, also in terms of slated determinant and plane waves, there's a very neat form.
Yeah, but this class of so continuous matrix product states are non-Gaussian, but this does not imply that they contain all Gaussians. If you create a Gaussian momentum space, this can be that this is not included in the class of continuous matrix product states. There are many critical theories, but which are quadratic or can be transformed to a quadratic problem, so which have a very easy solution in momentum space. It's just a Slater determinant or some kind of Gaussian wave function. But this is not included in the class of matrix product states because matrix product states don't contain any ground state that is critical, that has polynomial correlations, etc.
But this is not a critical state.
It's not critical, but still this momentum space, well, this Slater determinant of plane waves is not included in the class of continuous matrix product states. So there's no exact solution for this in this clause of continuous matrix product states.
If you give me a cutoff, you can always write down.
Yes.
I have a box and certain number of plane waves.
Yes.
And put it in the Slater determinant. I have an analytic form.
Yes.
What you are saying is I'm not able to rewrite it in the form that
yes.
you like.
Indeed.
That may be a technical form. It's a very good wave function.
Yes. It's able to very accurately approximate this. But even this case is not exactly included. But the nice thing is, if you would use Gaussian, that this case is exactly included, but go to an interacting theory and it can be very far off. Whereas what, and I think the best way to motivate this is just by people's experience. If you use this matrix product state clause or continuous matrix product state, the free theory might not be exactly included, But an interacting case is just as well included as a free case. So there's not much of a difference between free theories and interacting theories from the context of matrix product states or continuous matrix product states. So it's not exact, not even in the free case, but it's very accurate once you start to increase the bond dimension.
OK, maybe we should discuss.
OK, that's why we have discussion time.
Right.
I'm already over time, I see. But
yeah, but
So just the examples. So this plot is supposed to represent this filling exactly. So the red dashed line would represent the filling of this of these positive levels, which you don't want to be filled. The green line represents the filling of these negative levels, where this black thing here represents a cutoff up to where you want to fill them. And then you have this. This might not be very well visible. This black dotted line corresponds to some kind of mixture of filling between these two. For both a case where the mass gap over the cutoff is 1 over 10, and then for a case where there is no mass gap, so for the critical case. And what you see in the gapped case, as you increase the bond dimension, you start to reproduce this filling very well. Of course, there's no sharp cutoff in continuous matrix product states. You always have this 1 over moment to the power 4 decay of occupation. But also, this is very nicely reproduced. And then the other fillings, the ones that should be 0, also nicely go to 0 as the bond dimension is increased. In the critical case, it's less good, so you still have the intermediate levels are still perfectly filled, but the very low energy levels, there the filling goes down. Well, here it doesn't look to go down to precisely 0, but probably it does. So this is Feynman's sensitivity to high frequencies again, not because the cutoff is infinity, but because the infrared cutoff, so the correlation length is infinity because it's a critical case. This is free theories. Just as an example of other things that we can do with this formalism very, very easily, we study a thing like the Casimir energy, where we just have two plates, two defects in the system. It's actually very easy for this. We can use the same matrices Q and R that we used in the ground state and just do something with this boundary theory. We just add some virtual operator that acts in this boundary theory, and this kind of models the effect of these defects. And this would just be the real space energy when we place two plates here in the system. The red line would be just the ground state energy density when there are no plates. You see that you start to get these oscillations. And for people working in high energy physics, this might look very strange. But for condensed matter physicists, this will look very familiar, because this is exactly an effect of having our finite cutoff. These are Friedel oscillations. If we then look at the total energy as a function of the plate separation, then these Friedel oscillations also lead to oscillations there, which are resonances. Whereas an analytical computation without a cutoff or with an infinite cutoff would reproduce this red curve. And this blue one is the exact solution with the cutoff. So what we see is that the physical Casimir energy at infinite cutoff corresponds to the minima of this oscillating curve. And this is actually, as you increase the cutoff and the cutoff, what will happen is these minima will get wider and wider. And in the end, these peaks, these resonating peaks, will disappear. So our estimates are not, so from a quantitative point of view, they're not that good. But qualitatively, they reproduce the main features.
The red line would be?
The red line would be the exact solution from a field theory textbook, so without a cutoff, with special kind of regularization, which is called zeta regularization. Then the blue line is the exact solution when you have the cutoff. So just for the Hamiltonian that I used, including the cutoff term.
Okay. So the gas solution without using a CMPS.
Yes.
But just using the Hamiltonian that includes the...
Yes, and using the fact that it's a free theory so that you can... And actually, it's only very simple for when the mass is zero, so in the critical case. Even for the massive case, even though it's critical, even though it's quadratic, you can do it exactly, but it's still very hard, so I didn't do it at that point. And then the green line, as well as some of these others, but the others will not be visible at all, but the green line is the best numerical approximation that we found. So it's
and
quantitatively,
so
it's not very good, but...
All these oscillations are an artifact of the cutoff.
Yes. And also you can see that the energy is lower than what it should be, which is strange for a variational technique. But the thing is, of course, to compute Casimir energies, we subtract energies from each other. So it's not strictly variational anymore. We subtract a ground state energy, which was already approximate, so which was too large. And then we find something which is slightly smaller than the exact result. And then the final example is the Gross-Nevers model. So I didn't write down the Hamiltonian because I wanted to keep it not too technical today. So this is one of the most interesting theories probably for interacting fermions in 1+1 dimensions. So it describes n flavors of fermions which are massless and which interact with each other. And through this interaction, you can have chiral symmetry breaking and a dynamic generation of mass. And then there's a typical order parameter which is related to the mass gap that is generated in the system. And in the limit of large n, you can compute it exactly and you would get this blue line. This red line, I'm sorry. And then with the continuous matrix product state approximation up to a bond dimension of 16, and with these matrices that I put down here. So these are 16 by 16. You would find these green triangles. So here they are very close to the exact result. As we decrease the coupling, so this is a bit strange, as we decrease the interaction strength, we will be decreasing the mass gap. And so we're closer to criticality, and so then our results start to deviate from the exact result. So this is clearly just an effect of having a finite bond dimension. And so when we are able to go to larger bond dimension, we'll be able to follow this exact result for a bit deeper down into the weak regime. But if you do a finite size scaling, if you do just a scaling to these results that we have here, we can very accurately extract the scaling coefficients that appear in the exact results. So the conclusions for today are that the variational approach towards relativistic quantum field theories might not be so bad after all. And so these tensor network methods that have proven to be very successful in condensed matter applications and spin systems, etc. They seem to be also able to capture the low energy dynamics of relativistic theories. But in order to reproduce this or to find this, we have to introduce this cutoff. And when we try to shift this cutoff back to infinity, we're increasing the ratio between infrared cutoff and ultraviolet cutoff. Then we're plagued by this finite bond dimension and Feynman sensitivity to high frequencies reappears. So we need a better, in order to overcome this problem, we need a better ansatz that is able to also describe critical theory. So in the end, being able to do critical theories is the same as being able to do relativistic field theories. And this is, of course, well known. This is why Wilson studied both at the same time, where the renormalization group was developed for both at the same time. And well, thanks to GIFRE, we have such an ansatz, and this will be the topic of tomorrow. So this concludes my talk for today.
You solve the Grassner view model.
Yes.
There is an interaction coupling constant.
Yes.
Can you see how the matrix R tilde evolves as a function of coupling constant, let's say for the ground state? That will tell you the connection of possible connection of this simple slated determinant and the non-slated determinant states.
It's definitely possible to track down this matrix as a function of the coupling constant, but I would need to think how this, whether you can directly relate this to the stator determinants involved.
So I suspect that for non-interacting case, there should be some analytic form.
Yes.
You should be able to write down the stator determinants, rewrite it in this particular form.
But I don't think you can rewrite stator determinant just in this form. This is...
If I remember,
probably need to go to infinity.
Yeah.
The previous speaker's comment.
Yes.
He said that the structure of the wave function. He agreed that it looks like Bethe-Ansatz.
It looks.
We know that in the case of Bethe-Ansatz, we can go to non-interactive case and recover slated determinant. Except that the momentum will be replaced by pseudo momentum, and then this real space phase shifts.
Okay, but Frank knows more about this, but if you want to write the Bethe-Ansatz as a matrix product state, or probably also a continuous matrix product state, it looks like having infinitely many layers of this acting on top of each other. So if you contact all of these together, you need an infinite bond dimension in order to write this one Bethe-Ansatz wave function, or in the extreme case of a quadratic theory, this one Slater determinant as a matrix product state.
Any other question?
I just make a comment. I mean, if you want to find the best slated determinant for CMPS, you just compute the second limits. And then you have the covariance matrix, so you then know that analytically what is the that is by definition the closest.
Why is that the closest?
Well, in
which
relative entry. it's pragmatically closest. So if you could find the approximate state of the term of that one.
And then compare.
That's the other way around. That's from continuous matrix product state to a single state.